Welcome to The Ether. Today is Monday, March 7th, 2022. This episode of The Ether is brought to you by Orbital Command, a community validator on Terra dedicated to educating, expanding, and promoting the lunatic community. Have you heard about the new Terra Invest Strategy Discord server Orbital Command spun up? If you're looking for a chill place to chat about different Luna stacking strategies, or looking for some alpha, or if you're trying to find the best UST farms, or even if you just have a quick question you need answered, be sure to stop by TIS and say hi to the Orbital Command gang. Hell, I'm even in there sometimes when I'm not editing hours of CeFi spaces. You can find me in that server chatting about NFTs and answering basic Terra Luna questions. The link to the server is in the show notes, and for more information, check out orbitalcommand.io. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by Luart. Luart is the first gamified NFT platform built on the Terra network. Luart provides a seamless minting and trading experience, all while earning you rewards just for being a user. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the community in the Discord server for the most up-to-date news and announcements regarding all the hot new NFT launches, platform upgrades, and new projects hitting the secondary marketplace. Are you ready to put your helmet on and join the movement? Find out more at luart.io. Terra Spaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. Today on The Ether, Udiverse learns about Starknet with Eli Ben Sasson and Avihu 28. Let's take a listen.
And I always have the suspicion that he's just operating most of the accounts. But yeah, we'll start in a moment. I'm just going to throw some dad jokes until we do. How's everyone feeling? We're not going to talk about geopolitics today. I know this is the main interest of most of you guys, but I just don't have anything to say about it. Let's see. Avihu is here. He's going to connect in a moment. Hey, Avihu. What's up? Yeah, I can't hear you at all.
Sorry, I was muted. Hi, everyone. Howdy.
How are you doing?
Great. Decided to join from the road.
Is it like night for you right now?
Yeah. I'm on my way back and didn't anticipate the level of traffic. I hope you can hear me well.
Oh, you're driving right now? That's great.
Yep.
That's great. So these might be like your last moments.
If those are my last moments, I think I spend them the right way.
Exactly. Well, we're glad to have you here with us in those trying times. Let's see if Eli ever joins. If not, like you'll have everything on you. Oh, here Eli is. Let's see. I'll invite Eli to speak too. I hope my coughing sounds great, guys. I hope you're enjoying it. It used to be kind of scary when people coughed, but now it's socially acceptable. I'm going to start in just a moment. Eli, I sent you an invitation to speak. You should see a button on your screen so that you can start speaking. How's the bear market for everyone? Are you guys ready for 5 years of pain? Maybe six. I'm not seeing anyone laughing now. No. No laughs when I'm talking about the bear market. Okay, seeing some claps. We're just having some technical difficulties, so for now you'll have to listen to me making bad jokes, which is my expertise. Hey, Eli. We forgive you.
Okay.
How are you doing?
Very good
is great. You're, well, it's night for you right now too, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's great. It's not for me. It's early morning here. And when I say early, I mean, it's not that early.
You're early.
I'm early. Exactly. Well, I just wanted to, to start, I kind of just want to say the word, I'm looking for an excuse to say it, to say the word Starkavaganza. Am I the first moron who ever said that word?
For my record, in my record, yes.
Yeah.
You have that.
Ellie has like a few years more of Stark the jokes, I guess.
Yeah, well, I disagree with the moron part, but the first time I'm hearing it.
Great, great. So, yeah, so this is the first Twitter Spaces Starkavaganza. I can't even say it. It's like embarrassing to say it. But we're going to learn we're going to learn about Starks, because look, you guys are great people. I know you guys are great, but I don't believe any of the things you're saying about how Starknet is going to do amazing things, because it sounds, well, two things. One, it sounds very magical. Two, it sounds like way above my level of comprehension. So we're going to try to come to terms with, well, first the limits of my intelligence, and two, all of the fantastical claims that you guys are making, and we'll figure out the truth. I don't know how it's going to go. We're going to figure it out.
Sounds perfect.
Okay. So I'm just going to say, I'm going to give a quick intro. So for those of you who somehow don't know, Eli Ben Sassoon is the co-founder of Starkware, and he's also the co-inventor of ZK Starks, and I think ZK Snarks too. Why not? Let's say that he is. And Aviu is head of product. Yeah, okay. That's close enough. And Aviu is the head of product at Starkware. And together they are Eli and Aviu. let's try to understand what we've been talking about, because roll-ups, I guess you could say that Starknet is a type of a roll-up, but I don't even know how many people in the audience right now know what a roll-up is. So how about we start with you guys explaining what a roll-up even is?
I maybe can start, yeah, Eli, by giving some intuition, and then you will explain like the deep levels of a roll-up.
Yeah, I think intuition is fine. I think intuition is great.
Okay. So, Eli, do you want to go first, or should I?
Sounds like it's going to be you, Aviu.
Okay. I think the best intuition is like to explain what's limiting blockchains today, and what's limiting Bitcoin or Ethereum, and then why it's interesting to involve proofs and R2 and all those words that maybe not everyone are familiar with. So the thing is the following: say that you have a very successful blockchain, the Bitcoin blockchain, for example, and you have 10,000 computers that are following it, which means that every transaction that the network sees is being included in a block is being verified by each and every one of those 10,000 computers. And of this 10,000 computers, you have maybe, let's say, the 100 weakest computer in the network that we still want to be like part of the network. So because we want these 100 weakest computers in the network to follow everything, we need to make sure that if the rate of which transactions are joined into block and being processed in the network is 10 transactions per second, then we need to make sure that every computer can process at least 10 Bitcoin transactions per second. But now we're stuck at 10 transactions per second for the entire network. It doesn't really matter how good is the consensus of the network or how good is the network itself, the communication between nodes. We're still stuck at like those weak computers' ability to process 10 transactions per second. And that's basically the limitation. Now, one thing we can say is, okay, what's the problem? Let's just use larger blocks or higher gas limit and just stack more transactions in every second, make like bigger blocks with more transactions, and everything is fine. But the problem is, if you like take, if you can imagine like you're like some random, well, not a switch, but something that you can control the number of transaction network, then if you go just above 10, then those 100 weakest computer, you're losing them because they now don't follow the network anymore. So that's the main problem, right? If you move from 10 transactions per second to 20 or 100, you're going to lose more and more computer that can't follow the network, and eventually you're going to end up in a centralized network with, let's say, 100 participants, and that's bad. You don't want that. So this is a place where technology like Stark and this whole idea of layer two can come into play and is helpful. And it goes as following. Suppose that instead of taking all the transactions and send them directly to those 10,000 computers, including weak computers, you have at a time some strong computer that is ready to take slightly more work, and you send those transactions instead of to the entire network, you send them first. There is like a one computer that is ready to do something special with them. And this something special is creating a single proof, that what is what we call Stark proof, that incorporates all these 10,000 transactions and basically prove the validity of those transactions. So you can think of it as like this strong computer that we call sometimes a prover takes like, let's say, 1,000 transactions, compute them, make sure that they are correct, then generate a proof for those transactions. And the nice thing that this property that we care so much about in proofs is that once you've generated the proof, the verification time of the proof is very, very short. And also the proof length to send it on the network isn't growing much with the number of transactions. It's growing very, very slow. And for all practical means, you can assume that it's almost fixed. So this strong computer just does a little bit more work on these 1,000 transactions, but then he can send them to the rest of the network, and it's very, very cheap to verify them. So now we created a system where out of the 10,000 computers in the network, it's enough that one computer is strong, and 9,999 computers can be weak enough just to verify the proof, and they don't really need to verify each and every transaction. Then you can go from 10 transactions per second to, let's say, 100 or even 1,000. And as long as the large computer can handle with the generation of the proof that is slightly more than the computation, say 100 times more expensive than the computation, then all works great in a much higher throughput and much higher scale. So this is the intuition.
So you move a lot of transactions somewhere else, and somehow not everyone has to verify them, and that just allows you to do more of them because not everyone has to verify everything that happens. So that's the general idea behind rollups. And right.
The last sentence you said is actually the if you had to summarize everything, is not everyone has to verify everything. That's like where the magic happens.
Right. Because that's the hard part. Yeah. But I guess the important thing is you don't have to verify everything, but you still get the same or very similar guarantees that you would have gotten if everyone was verifying, right?
Yes, exactly. The meaning of proof is that there is, even if this big computer that generates a proof is a malicious computer and he wants to push inside those 1,000 transactions one transaction that is invalid and generate a proof, he just can't. This ability just doesn't exist, or is very, very low. There is a very low chance that he will be able to convince someone that the proof is correct if even one single transaction or even one step in the transaction is false. So that's basically where the magic happens.
Okay, great. So I know that in the audience right now, there's probably like a mix of people who are more familiar with Bitcoin and some are more familiar with Ethereum and some were maybe not technically familiar with any of them. And I want to go and talk about Bitcoin stuff and scaling solutions in Bitcoin too. We'll do that later. But first, I want to kind of compare what you guys are talking about to what is also being built on Ethereum. So like, obviously, StarkNet and Stark Proofs, which we're going to talk about, is one of the options for scaling Ethereum. There's also what people call optimistic rollups on Ethereum, which we probably shouldn't go too much into them. But I guess what would you say is the main benefit that something like StarkNet, which you guys are building, provides over the other Ethereum scaling solutions?
Okay. I will try, like, first I will relate to Ethereum and I will explain in a couple of sentences for those who are not familiar. So our, as I explained it, our basic in Zika rollups or in validity-based rollups, those rollups are based on proofs. Every state transition, every time you move from state A to state B, it's accompanied with a proof, which means that the protocol itself is simple in a sense that every state is valid the moment a proof is verified on chain. And so this is like one possibility. The other possibility is to say, well, let's, and this is the optimistic rollup direction, is to say, well, let's assume that the state, let's put a new state on chain. If the state is valid, all is great. If the state is invalid, we are going to give some period of time where people can point on the invalidity of the state, and there will be some process of proving fraud. And the hard part there is to make sure that the protocol support in proving any fraud possible, and that there are enough people watching the state and verifying everything at every point in time to make sure that you really get a valid state eventually. I want to talk mainly about our approach. I don't want too much to like other solutions. I think that's the more interesting part. So I think, first of all, if I just take a look in on Ethereum and on Ethereum scale, then I can say that I think that our protocol is pretty straightforward. It doesn't involve very long times in state transitions. And as the technology gets better, the state transition times will get shorter and shorter. And the funny thing is that the more the network gets populated and the more transactions are coming per second, then you'll see more frequent proofs and you'll see more frequent state transitions. And the time to a new, valid, fresh state on chain will get shorter, shorter and shorter. The second advantage, and this I'm going to say something, I'm not sure it's going to be clear in the first go, but I will repeat it later in the Bitcoin context, and I think it will be more clear. The first thing is that in all other solutions, there has to be a group of computers that rerun the computation. You can't avoid it. And it doesn't matter if your solution is a sidechain with a smaller group of validators, or if your solution is an optimistic rollup with a group of validators that are watching the chain to detect fraud, you have to watch the chain and you have to recompute every transaction. And StarkNet is, or validity-based rollups, is basically the best, the only place where you can run an even very, very complex computation. Once you generate the proof, nobody has to rerun the computation, no matter how complex it is. And this computation can be steps in a game, it can be like a list of transactions, signatures, can be everything. And you have like the flexibility to define basically new programs that so far they were like prohibited. It wasn't possible to put them on any blockchain because they consume too much computation, they consume too much data, that even like on scaling solutions that that aim to solve some of the scalability, they will still be too expensive. And this idea that you can take the computation, rerun it just once, and then forget about it, and forget about all the data that is incorporated with this computation, this can like enable people to put programs on chain that we've never seen before. So I think that's like the most interesting gem in validity proofs.
Right, right. So I'm just as a reminder, I have zero knowledge about zero knowledge. So I'm trying to figure. This is probably a joke that you guys hear every day, by the way, but not me.
I'd say every week.
Yeah. So I'm trying to figure this out as we go. So I'm gonna rephrase what you just said and see if I got it. So you're saying that with optimistic rollups, which is another type of scaling solution, people will only be able to prove that something went wrong. So if you use the thing, you use the rollup, and you make transactions, and you cannot prove that things are okay, but if someone tries to cheat, then someone could prove that if they're looking. And the difference
is, think about it. Maybe let me yeah. do a, like a simpler explanation. Think about this. So it doesn't really matter. I think there are other scaling solutions for maybe other use cases, but the end goal from our perspective is that no matter how long the computation that you have and no matter how long the data that it requires to run the computation, we don't want the entire network to work hard. Now, in every solution, including optimistic rollups, eventually you need people to watch the chain and to make sure that state transition is correct. And in optimistic rollup, you can't assume that there is someone out there doing it, and therefore no one will do it, because eventually if no one is doing it, the solution won't be secure. And it's true for each and every other solution. So eventually you need to have a group of computers that you don't know who they are, or at least you don't know at least part of those entities that are watching each and every transaction in the network that is being included in the block, and are making sure that it's valid. And if this transaction is a computation with 1 billion steps, then they have to rerun it to make sure that it's valid. They yeah. have to.
And yeah, so let's look at an example of what this actually looks like. So I want to like, you know, put it in context that people can see. So there are actually things that work right now with SOG proofs. There was big news today about Immutable X raising, I believe, around $200 million. So Immutable X is an NFT platform and gaming platform that's built with Stark Proofs. And there's DYDX, which is also built on Stark Proofs. So can you guys tell me how those are different in the user experience? Not really in the technical sense, but on the user experience, how they're different from other NFT platforms and other trading platforms that are using, let's say, base layer Ethereum or some other blockchains.
I think the user experience is very much like that of a centralized exchange. You see very fast finality, very low costs. That's what I think the user experience looks like. But the simplest way is to, try it on either Diversify or DYDX or Immutable X.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I honestly would recommend trying it. I tried it myself and it does. That's exactly what it feels like. It feels like you go to a normal centralized service.
What did you try, Udi?
I tried DYDX. And it does, yeah, it does feel like just an exchange, just like any exchange. And of course, the benefit over a centralized exchange is that you are guaranteed to be able to
draw. I have an analogy, right? It's like, you walk onto this, you walk into this hall and you sit inside a chair. And you have a window next to you and you look outside and you see that you're suddenly up in the air and you're flying, right? And it feels just like sitting in a chair, but there was some magic that took you up in the air, you know, on an airplane. So here it's, you know, by analogy, it feels like a centralized exchange, but it's completely self-custodial. You are the only one holding the keys to your assets. Never do you assume any trust in the platform, in the, you know, you're not entrusting them with anyone else. So it's a little bit of magic that's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. I do recommend trying it. It's pretty cool because, yeah, it does feel like using any centralized exchange, but it is self-custodial. So that's pretty awesome. And on that note, those current products like DYDX and ImmutableX and others, they're not using what you guys call StarkNet, right? They're using something else?
Right.
They're using, so basically we have built to this point two products, you can call it. The first one is StarkX, and this is actually a roll-up, a system that is in production since June 2020, and they're running on top of it. And the main benefit there is that you can save gas and the user experience gets better, but it does work on, first of all, it does work on a centralized operator. And second, it works with a very specific logic that is predefined. It means that it supports trading, it supports transfers, it supports minting, and a predefined set of operations that you can do. And that's great for all those use cases where either you already run something that is like partially centralized over a blockchain. For example, you had an order book and the settlement happened on Ethereum, or you have something in the real world that you're running in a centralized way, but you don't want to take, for example, you don't want to take custody, or you want that every single state transition in your application will be proven from 101 reasons. So that's StarkX, and that's what DYDX, ImmutableX, Diversify, Storer running on today. And it's a system that can support very high throughput, and there is like an interesting list of use cases that we'd probably see through the year running on top of StarkX. So that's one thing. And StarkNet is a network in all kinds of senses. Basically, the main difference is that StarkNet is a network. And being a network means that, first of all, anyone can deploy any logic. So you're not limited to this predefined logic of StarkX. You can deploy any smart contract you'd like with any logic. Smart contracts can interact with each other. A transaction can call my smart contract, which will call yours, and so on. Like the same concept you are familiar with from Ethereum. And in addition, there is no limitation for a centralized operator, meaning everyone can be an operator, everyone can run a prover, and it's going to be a completely permissionless network.
Yeah, so StarkX right now and the products available right now are still kind of running on a centralized server, but StarkNet, they're running on a centralized server, but they're self-custodial. And StarkNet Correct. Will let them run services in a way that is permissionless without a centralized server and without Right. anyone who can stop them, right?
Correct. Yes.
And that's not available yet?
So it is available. What's available is the part where I'll give some like dates. So StarkNet on testnet is available since last June, and StarkNet on mainnet in its alpha version is available since November. Alpha version means that you can currently deploy smart contract that supports any logic, which is different from StarkX already. And you can interact with the chain. And we are now making the improvements for this chain to support a very high throughput. But it's still centralized, meaning at this point, there is still just one single operator that sequences transactions together into blocks and proves blocks into layer one. So that's what exists today. And by the end of the year or towards the end of the year, we plan to also decentralize the operation. So everyone will be able to run an operator.
Right, right. Okay, by the end of the year. Okay, you heard it at first. I'm writing it in my calendar. So
that's good. Yeah.
Okay, good. And by the way, I'm seeing some people who are raising their hands and requesting access to the stage. We'll get there. We'll get there. I'm gonna still try to ask some of my very basic questions, but in the end of the session, we'll do a Q&A too. So stick around. And okay, so I understand. I understand the difference. I understand when it's supposed to be here. And how about, so the type of things, let's say, you know, if someone is developing one of these applications, then, you know, one of the main reasons they would probably might prefer something like StarkNet over StarkX is because they want the guarantee that they're never going to be taken down, right? Like if you're a developer, you want to know that you're going to stay there. So that's what developers are going to, I assume, going to be looking for. But the same developers, they're going to, you know, other things they care about is they want to be able to maybe use current code that they've been using so far. Is that something that people will be able to do to take their code from, let's say, Ethereum smart contracts and use it on StarkNet?
Eddie, you want to take it?
I'll repeat the question.
You're doing an amazing job. So I think, you know, there's nothing really, have you go for it.
Okay. So
I'm just listening and enjoying here, you know?
Okay, no problem.
Tahuti's not the only one learning here, right? Go for it.
So I'll start by saying that Ellie is hosting this series of Stark at Home. And it's occasionally on Thursdays. And I think this Thursday is going to host a very nice session with the Warp team. Which
you see, I learned something here.
Yeah, in a second, you'll see why it's relevant. I hope I'm not mistaken with the date. So the first answer is that you will have the ability, if you wish, to take your Solidity code and transpile it to Cairo smart contract on StarkNet. And to do that, there is a very cool.
I'll just stop you for a moment. Cairo is what?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So Cairo is a language that we started developing, and I think at this point it's being developed. Hopefully, will be also. We will continue to develop, but there is also like all kind of toolings and compilers from other languages being developed by external teams. And Cairo basically enables something which is pretty, like not pretty, very, very amazing, which is to take any program, write it in a, well, human programming language, and not as some polynomial constraints that represent the program. And you can still prove the execution of this program, which I know it sounds very trivial because, hey, we set computation and everything, but it's not. And when we started to work in Stark, where, I don't know, like 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago, and later on when we built Stark X, we had to write by hand, basically, the constraints, meaning if we wanted something that represented a trade between you and me, Udi, we had to think, what is the right representation of this program that represents trade in some mathematical language? And writing this mathematical language, writing it without mistakes, writing it fast, writing it so it's like flexible to like any computation is a very, very extremely hard task, and only a few people could do it. And we realized that we can't progress this way. If we want to at some point we want to get to the ability to write complex programs. If we can't do it, it will be very hard for other people on the planet as well. So this is where Cairo came, and Cairo is basically it's a set of comparable or very simple constraints that represent a simple virtual machine. And once it's in place, you can write your program in Cairo and compile it to a bytecode of this virtual machine that is being proven. So it's pretty amazing. And Cairo is, I think, at this point is more convenient to write, but it's still, I think it's fair to say that it's still a fairly low-level language. And so we have external effort, like the one that I just mentioned, to take other languages and compile it into Cairo. So now, if I may go back to your question, if you want to take Solidity code and transpile it to Cairo, you can. There is a great, great, fantastic team led by Greg Vardy that is called Warp. And they basically enable you to take your Solidity code, transpile it to Cairo, and surprisingly, you don't get such a big downgrade in the performance. I think the upcoming version, there is already one version released, and the upcoming version, I think, is going to show some magnificent improvement, and maybe you'd get to, I don't know, I'm just throwing here a number, I don't know what's the exact number, 5x worse performance on the transpiled Cairo versus if you would write it by hand. But it is a useful tool. Let's answer in your question directly, right?
Yeah. So you're saying there's already tools that people can use to take their smart contracts from Solidity and transpile them into something that will work in StarkNet.
Right. And then the second point, which is probably more important, is that the code that you wrote in Solidity, it optimized for very specific things. It optimized for gas cost, and it optimized or was written to work with existing tools on Ethereum, which makes total sense, right? Like you'd use the cryptography that Ethereum supports, the precompiles that Ethereum supports, and you will basically optimize your code so that maybe sometimes you will give up some functionality or some security because, well, if you wouldn't, then things will get too expensive to the point where it will be like too much, won't even fit to a block or maybe even to like a block in a more centralized EVM sidechains, right? So this is how you wrote your code, and this was fine. But now you have the ability to write code where computation is much cheaper, data is much cheaper. So the claim is that you'd anyway take your code and you will rewrite it in a way that makes more sense to your logic. So what I'm saying is that while you have the ability, and I think it's a good, like for those who are migrating or want to try Starknet with their own existing Solidity code, you can try it with Warp. I think it's a good tool. But I think that it makes tons of sense, definitely for the large DeFi protocols, to basically rewrite their logic so they can use the abilities that Starknet offers them. And we see it with Maker protocol, we see it with other protocol, we start seeing it now. We see it with Snapshot. It makes a tons of sense to just change your protocol so you can exploit those things.
Yeah, you're like saying when you're building an Ethereum app, then you know it has to be based on the idea that transactions are going to be expensive and slow, and any kind of, you know, any kind of interaction with oracles or whatever, it will be will be done between blocks, which can be pretty further apart. And these things like make a lot of influence on how the protocols themselves are being designed. And if you remove all those restrictions, then you can design maybe much more elegant protocols.
Yes. And sometimes the change in the protocol is like, is crazy. I'll give maybe two examples. Can I give two
Please
examples
do.
And not one?
Please do.
Okay. So in the YDX, for example, I don't know exactly the details, but before StarkX, they used to work with a very limited number of markets and Oracle price that is being updated in a much lower frequency. And basically, since they moved to StarkX, they were able to change it to support or like very, very frequent Oracle price updates, I think once per minute sometimes, or maybe even once per second or a few seconds. And they were able to support a single position holding multiple assets, I think up to 64 assets. So it's like, it's a different game, right? Like now you can hold balance in many coins and they all count together for your balance. And this is like a different application, basically. It's not just better user experience, it also enables you to do things, to have features that you couldn't have before. And I will go to a more complex example, being risk that I won't be understood on this one, but I'm going to try. Udi, do you know the snapshot voting app?
I know it now because a spoiler alert, you told me about it once. So now I know.
Oh, okay. Okay. Good idea. So the idea there, it's not all the possibilities, but the most common or one of the common ways to use it is to, well, basically there is a vote. Let's say we vote on which pizza we like, or how are we going to spend $200 million. You know, this kind of votes that you can see in DAOs. And then there is like some off-chain process where I sign yes or no, and you sign that you like tomatoes and tuna, and everyone sign and send their signed decision, the signed like vote.
It's a voting app.
Yeah, it's a voting app. Yeah, I didn't say it. Sorry. And then at some point you say, okay, that's enough. You count the votes, and this is the interesting part. And then you compare them to the balance that each and everyone had in some specific point in time on chain. Did you get it?
I got it.
Okay, perfect. Now, the thing there is that, well, first of all, if you want to verify it on chain, it's extremely expensive because you have to verify each and every signature. But there is even worse part. And the worst part is that you need to know what was the balance of each and every token holder who voted at a very specific point in time. And this is not what's their current balance, which you can just ask the state. This is some historical balance. So this is a big problem. Now, some tokens, they have this awful mechanism to just record checkpoints in the history. So they just remember, okay, Udi had yay many tokens in this block, and then 100 blocks later, he had a change in this balance. But that's horrible because it's basically blowing the state. Basically means that every checkpoint, you remember the balances of everyone who you expect to vote. So either you have like a very small number of voters in your token, or you're costing tons of gas to the network. And in Starknet, I'm not going to get into all the details, but in Starknet, you can change it. You can basically take snapshot. Using layer one balances, using Ethereum balances, you can count, you can verify the votes, not just the signature, but also your historical balance in a way that doesn't require you to do it on layer one anymore. And it's a weird example, but it shows that you can actually take applications that work on Ethereum, that interact with Ethereum, that use the Ethereum token balances, and you can do stuff with them on Starknet enables them to do stuff that they can't do on Ethereum. So it's pretty crazy example, even if we didn't go to the details of it.
So even though you know, even though people would say that Ethereum is I guess some people call it a computer, and you could run any arbitrary programs, in practice the limits are very limiting. So it really puts a very severe limit on what you can actually build because of storage limits and because of size limits and processing limits. And if you use something like Stark proofs to compact all of these, then suddenly a lot of the things that are only theoretical with Ethereum, they become practical, right?
Right. And you can even run computations on Starknet that reports back to Ethereum. You can use Starknet for all kinds of computations, not just for applications on Starknet, but also for applications on Ethereum.
Huh, that's interesting. I think I got it.
Yes, yes.
I'm a small brain, but I think I got it. So I'm trying to kind of think about what other potential use cases there could be for this. And one thing that keep popping into my mind is stuff like gaming. I remember how the CEO of Epic Games, he has a lot of Tim Sweeney, he has a lot of thoughts about blockchain stuff and whether or not they apply to gaming. And obviously a lot of
you know, a lot of crypto gaming companies are constantly quoting him and trying to convince him that, that blockchain is the future. But he, you know, he's talking about it quite a lot. And he often says things like, okay, well, you know, Fortnite is our most popular game and it has, you know, millions of players at any given time and they can do, you know, thousands of different actions and they're moving around and they're jumping around, shooting each other, and they're doing a lot of stuff. And maybe based on that, they're going to get some rewards, maybe not. And it's just not even remotely practical to do any of that, not on Ethereum and not on any blockchain, really, because the numbers are just ridiculous. So is something like that, I probably not now, but is something like that even remotely possible with Starks? Should it be? And like, how do you look at stuff like games?
Yes, it is. So it's not so remotely this. I think some of the potential killer applications that are going to emerge in Starknet are probably of this nature, because gaming and virtual spaces are a very natural fit for blockchains. And the place where you can deploy them now, like Ethereum, is very compute limited. Starknet's going to open that. And over time, you'll see much greater scale for computation, which definitely will allow this. Now, just like, you know, the early games had whatever, 1K memory and probably processing power that was very small, and still people enjoyed them a lot. I don't want to betray my age, but I still remember the first Atari that I got with cartridges of, again, of 1K for playing Asteroids and Pac-Man and stuff like that. It was very fulfilling, you know. I spent so much time on it, like, you know, not that my parents liked that, but anyways. So I think similar things are going to be on Starknet. So initially you see the analog of the, you know, Atari, whatever that first version was, and people are going to enjoy it immensely. And over time you'll get closer to Fortnite and beyond. Yeah, that's definitely going to happen. Irrespective of what, you know, Tim Sweeney says about NFTs or, you know.
Maybe we'll also come at some point.
I hope so.
I want to say two more things. One, we already, like, we see a lot of interest from all kind of game developers and game companies. I think we even deployed earlier this week, or maybe it was last week, some version of Game of Life. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
Yeah, that's the popular coding exercise, right?
Yeah, it's basically like starting from some state and define like some pretty simple rules, but then evolving to potentially a way more complex state with more life forms that you could anticipate. And this is like a very simple game, but you can already see a version of it on Starknet. And the cool thing is that you can, you know, move the step forward, record the some whatever step that you think that is cool, and it's verifiable that you got to this state from some seed. So I think that's nice. I wanted to say that there it's obvious that obviously it's going to take some time before you'd actually see a more complex games on chain, and even then it's probably going to be some specific game logic and not the entire graphics and so on. But there are also some advantages in proofs that you'd get in games that doesn't exist in the real world. I just have like maybe two in my head. I'll give one. That's like today in the real world, there is like the player side and the server side, and the server doesn't trust the player because obviously the player want to win against all the other players. So the player can only do like very limited number of steps before they have to report to the server and get like, okay. And it's not just, even if they can progress a lot of steps before talking with other players, they're basically limited because the server doesn't trust them. So it's going to tell them, okay, stop, show me what you got. I'll tell you what the next thing is. And it makes sense. If you let players the ability to change their own state, to run the program how they like, then they will make sure that they are winning. So you can do that. So you have some network overhead and server overhead and all that. And here you can basically let the players do more steps in whatever games you are playing without the need to report to the server, because the server doesn't need to trust the player. The player can just prove that whatever he did was following the game logic. Doesn't even need to tell everything that he did. It can maintain some level of privacy that you don't have today in games. And that's also another cool feature that you don't have today in traditional games. So I'm very curious, like everyone else in the world, to see what will come out of this.
Yeah. Yeah, like you would have, yeah, that's interesting. Like you would have to, if you want to trust the server now, that server would have to like relay all of everyone's moves in a very like high resolution so that you can kind of see if they make sense. But you're saying actually that's not necessary if you have proofs. That's cool. So I'm trying to think through like more, you know, more consumer oriented stuff that you know that we aren't as used to seeing with blockchains and crypto now. Like gaming is one of them, and something else that you know a lot of people are talking about in the crypto space is like stuff like social networks. And obviously, you know, now with I promised I'm not going to go into geopolitics, but obviously with you know everything going on in the world right now and some social networks being actually blocked in entire countries, then this whole idea of censorship resistant media and social networks becomes more, you know, something people talk about a lot more. And like I know that you guys had some experiment with Reddit around that or with the Reddit community around that. And how are you guys generally thinking about social media and stocks?
I think that social media is a special case of something with very, very high throughput and very low cost or willingness to spend per tweet, for instance. I mean, if I had to, you know, pay a cent every time I put a dumb tweet out, then, you know, I'd be broke very soon. And I'm not even the worst, right? There are people who tweet out more. So anyways, if you want to do put things like social media on a censorship-resistant, permissionless network, because let's say you're an ex US president that can't find a place to speak anymore, not taking any sides here politically speaking, but as an extreme example, so the question is, where can this be supported? And for that, you need efficient scale. And I think Starks are really a good candidate technology for that. Relatedly, you know, interestingly, the famous white paper of Satoshi mentions micropayments and the need to remove human processing as one of the reasons for starting Bitcoin, complaining that, you know, you don't have micropayments on credit cards and other electronic networks because there's a human factor that is very costly. So he or she envisioned right, something that would allow you to do very, to use something like a blockchain for things that cost very little, like micropayments and tweets and social media examples. But for that, you need the technology that will allow you both the permissionlessness, the integrity, and the scale. And yeah, definitely Starks can play a role here.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, that would be interesting. And you mentioned Bitcoin. I wanna go into how maybe, you know, Starks and Cairo and stuff could in the future, maybe theoretically, I'm using a lot of qualifying words here, but could maybe apply to Bitcoin at some point. But before that, I have one more question. I think Avi maybe touched on that a little bit. I know that there's, you know, when people talk about scaling solutions for blockchains and for Ethereum specifically, and when they mention stuff like rollups, there's a question of like interoperability between them? Like, could apps on Starknet be aware of, I don't know, apps elsewhere and somehow be interoperable with them? How would that work?
So the short answer is definitely yes. And it really depends on what is the other thing. But because I mentioned it before, but on Starknet, you can verify any computation. And this computation can be me transferring you money, but it can also be some light client logic or bridge logic, which means that if you want to take, if you want to say, I want to verify some transactions that were executed somewhere else were valid, or I want to verify that the same way that light clients verify that the Bitcoin proof of work chain, I know a chain of some specific lengths that get to this block, and this is the block header, and this is a transaction that was included, then you can. And it means that you can create trustless bridge or almost trusted bridge that just needs someone to feed them with the information, but they don't need to trust this someone. And that's very cool. And also, and we will see bridge of all kind of tastes and types emerging in Starknet. Some will be trusted, some will be trustless. And there is also one native bridge, which is an important one. It is the bridge to Ethereum, which Starknet as a layer 2 to Ethereum today enables you to have to know. It basically can know the Ethereum state and do all kind of computation or verification on transactions or state previous storage that was part of this state, which is cool.
Gotcha. Okay, so look, you know, I think this whole interoperability thing is a good bridge to talk about my favorite topic, which is Bitcoin. And here are my thoughts. So I think maybe the surprising thing about something like Starknet that maybe people don't necessarily fully grasp is that really what you need is a way for Starknet to work. What you need is a way to metaphorically move assets from the main chain to Starknet, and then they can do whatever. And then you want another way to metaphorically move them back to the main chain. For that, the main chain will have to be able to verify some proofs. But that's all you need. And then, you know, all the things that the Star proofs can do, they don't require extra abilities from the main chain. So for example, the reason you can connect something like Starknet to Ethereum and then run some programs on the Starknet side, the programs running on the Starknet side have nothing to do with the EVM that exists on Ethereum. They have nothing to do with Solidity necessarily. They could, but they don't have to have anything to do with Solidity. So they can just work. And the only thing that the main chain needs to do is to be able to verify the proofs. But it doesn't have to have necessarily a general purpose computer. So theoretically, if there was a way to attach Starknet to Bitcoin, and right now there isn't one that it's live, but if there was a way to attach them, then you could see people using Starks not only for scaling Bitcoin, but also to add programmability to Bitcoin in a way that is verifiable and secure. And that also matches a lot about the ethos of the Bitcoin community, which is, you know, that proofs need to be or you know, whatever the main chain does should be as lightweight as possible, and you don't want to overload it with stuff because everyone needs to have access to it. So you can still retain that because the main chain doesn't have to do anything unique other than proving than verifying those proofs, which is cheap. So you can add programmability without any you know, significant costs to the main chain. So that's the way I see it. Now, you guys can either tell me I'm wrong or tell me what's missing for us to get there.
You're right, and I will say, I think it's maybe some parts of what I'm going to say will sound surprising, because they are. So you need two things to support fully what we have today on starting this layer two. One is verification of start proofs. If you have just that, it's already nice, because you could make sure, like the Bitcoin chain will basically make sure that some other sidechain, like Starknet, is correct. But what you need in addition, if you want to have like a fully functional Starknet as layer two to Bitcoin, where you can send Bitcoins to Starknet and from Starknet in a trustless way, is you also need some kind of covenant or a way to hold state. You basically want that the verification of the proof will control how many coins are being released from some UTXO and to who. And once you have that, then you have full layer two. So you need covenants in some way, and you need the start verification. Once you have those two, you can have like general logic being verified on Bitcoin, and this general logic can use Bitcoin as a currency, which is an important part, right?
Yeah, and it is surprising because it's not a lot, and it adds programmability to Bitcoin, which doesn't have programmability, and we're not talking about adding programmability to it either.
Right. I also think that people will be surprised. I know that this topic of covenants were discussed a lot in the Bitcoin community. I think people will be surprised how close, or actually, I think that at the very beginning, there was some concatenation opcode that could at least theoretically enable this. But even if that's not the case now, I think that there was already a long discussion. I think that this part is probably mature enough to go into serious discussion. And then there is the question of verification of starks, which is probably going to need to be a separate opcode.
By the way,
I have one more thing to say. Yeah, go ahead, Eddie.
No, go ahead. I'll add it there.
I just wanted to say one more thing. I don't think, like, some stuff that can be both like nice but even useful to Bitcoin can be done with Starks today. And I think it's not, you won't have to wait with it that long time into the future before we see some first functional stuff that use Starks for Bitcoin. I would say, I don't know what, it's a matter of a few months to a whatever, 6 months, 9 months, or up to a year, even without any changes to Bitcoin at all, there are still some very useful things that you can do with Starks to help Bitcoin.
So I wanted to add that another two important aspects of Starks that are especially important for Bitcoin are the lack of any need for a trusted setup, which is very much in line with the principles of Bitcoin. And also the post-quantum security and very lean and, you know, well-trusted cryptographic assumptions that underlie Stark. So, and I'm saying this because, you know, early on when Snarked and various things with trusted setups came along, you know, the Bitcoin community was saying, okay, we're not going to ever allow such things because they require some trusted setup, and, you know, maybe the trusted setup doesn't work well. So with Starks, you don't have that. And also you get post-quantum security and very lean cryptography. And I just want to repeat what Avio said. We definitely expect to see some Bitcoin-related stuff appearing on Cairo and Starknet, even without any action on behalf of, you know, without any necessarily forks inside Bitcoin core. But hopefully this will further
get the appetite of Bitcoin to adopt this technology, which is really I can't envision Bitcoin achieving its goal of being like this thing that is massively used and not just be a store of value without it adopting Starks. I just can't see them bridging the gap and reaching whatever 100 or 1,000 TPS and more.
I want to comment on something. Ellie was there, I think, in 2013. Maybe there was even a previous mention, but in 2013, Ellie gave a talk. I think it was on the West Coast, Ellie.
Yeah, so.
And I think this talk was already mentioned by Greg Maxwell as a potential improvement and something that is interesting to watch for the coming years for Bitcoin. So I think people recognize that it's like, once this technology has evolved enough, it makes tons of sense to push it into Bitcoin. And I think at this point we are, well, practically, we think it has evolved to the level where it might make sense already.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that I definitely remember people like Greg Maxwell early on talking at the very least about the idea of using zero knowledge proofs, both to scale and to add programmability to Bitcoin. I think a lot of people used to talk about that very early on. And I think it does match the ethos of the Bitcoin community in many ways, both because there's no trust assumption and also because there's very little cost that you have to add for current Bitcoin nodes. So you can gain all of that added functionality, not only scaling, but also added functionality without having the nodes incur significant costs. So that's pretty cool. Now, obviously, everything around Bitcoin development is done in a way that kind of prioritizes safety and reliability. So that means that developers like these are slow, not because they're necessarily challenging, but because people really want to be very sure about them.
I want to say something.
Yep.
Actually, two things about it. First of all, I mentioned it earlier. There are things that are very useful that can be done today with like zero changes to Bitcoin. In fact, I'm sure people like from the Bitcoin community will do them. And I wanna explain like one particular very interesting thing. I guess some people heard about SegWit, and those who won, doesn't really matter for the explanation. But basically, every Bitcoin block, there is like the part of like what are the transactions that are being spent, and then there is like what is the computation that you need to do to verify this spending, and what is like the data, sometimes being called the witness, for this computation, like the signatures, and so on. And there is like some whatever half or three quarters of every piece of data in the Bitcoin chain is probably this part, the part of the witness, and every node in the network, when it gets the latest block, it has to verify it by rerunning the entire computation. And anyone, and so, and if you want to sync, even as a, like a light client, as a light client, you'd only have to download all the block headers and verify the proof fork. And as a full node, you'll have to download all this node data, all this witness data, and rerun the entire computation. Now, you can already today, you can work on a Cairo program that either verify the proof of work for every block header, or even verify a more complex set of rules of some of the popular UTXOs, and to the extreme, verifies the entire script language that is in the Bitcoin client. And it's not a short code, but it's not a very complex one either. And practically, those scripts that are being used popularly are not many flavors of them. And once you have this Cairo program for this particular program, you can now say, well, I don't really have to verify. I don't have to really download this witness. And I don't really have to verify the entire computation of every block. I can just download a proof instead and verify the proof. It will, on large blocks, will be shorter. Now, sure, you have to have an entity to generate these proofs. But once you did, you can verify Bitcoin blocks much, much faster. And it goes further. It goes like to some more crazy story. Because now let's say that your node was down and you're up and you need to resync your node. So you need to download like a lot of blocks and you need to verify all of them. And that sometimes takes some time. And if you're going to run on a lower hardware box, then it's going to take longer. And so there is a limit of which box can handle it and which how much time. And with proofs, you don't have to generate a proof for a single block. You can generate a proof for, let's say, 100 blocks. And you can even generate proofs that prove proofs, but I don't even need to get into that. Basically, with proofs, you can make the full sync verification much, much faster because there can be like a proof for every 100 blocks that saves you the time to verify each and every block and even saves you the time to download the witness. It requires zero changes to the protocol. It does require a lot of Cairo work to implement all the Bitcoin logic and then some effort to prove all the Bitcoin chain. But it can be done today with zero changes to the Bitcoin protocol, and I'm sure that people will do it. And that's something that can help Bitcoin today, at least on the requirements for people to run full node, for example, or the speed of syncing new full node or even light node.
Yeah, that's actually pretty cool. So you could get like a running full node from scratch and verify its past state without really doing the verification yourself, which can take hours or maybe days depending on your hardware. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It also gives you, once you have it, you can prove the state to like everywhere. You can prove the state on Ethereum, you can prove the state on Starknet. I don't even know what are all the things that you can do with it, but it's probably a useful piece. I agree that it's not like still the scale that we want to see on Bitcoin, but it's a step in the right direction.
Right. Yeah, that's awesome. Okay, that's cool. And I think with that, I'm pretty much ready to open this up for questions from the audience. But before, and of course, if anyone has any question, just ask for permission to speak and I'll let you ask a question. But before that, is there anything else any of you two want to say before we bring in the trolls?
Sunscreen, very, very important.
Sounds good. Okay, so if anyone wants to ask any question, just ask for permission to speak and I'll let you come on stage. And let's start with, we'll start with Elon. Let's see.
Is that Elon Musk?
I don't think so, but he will tell us.
Hey guys, shalom, anishma. I mean, I guess maybe to the first, to what you just said, you know, sunscreen hurts like coral reefs some in some places in the world, so maybe it's not that good always, but yeah. So I have like a question. You know, we're talking about usually in blockchains, you know, there's like this trilemma, right, of decentralization, scalability, and security. And on the surface of it, it seems like, especially, you know, Starknet all three problems at once. But like, I feel like the more I kind of like dive deeper into it, like there's one thing that's missing for me, and it's, you know, these provers, how complex it is, and, you know, what are sort of like the minimum requirements to run a prover? Because, you know, if you know, that's, if you need a dedicated machine for that, then, you know, you're sort of downgrading the potential decentralization because you're only allowing certain people to be able to sort of like compute. But then I guess on the other hand, just, you know, to continue this for a second, on the other hand, like you are creating maybe a centralization in the production of the proofs or the blocks in a blockchain, but you're simplifying, you know, the ability to verify these blocks. And, you know, anyone can do that very simply. So maybe that's kind of like the trade-off. So, yeah.
I would start and then maybe Eli can top me. I think, first of all, the most important and common measure of decentralization is how many full nodes you have in your network. And that means how many people can like trustlessly, independently verify the state of the chain without trusting anyone else. And that's important if you are an exchange or a bridge or just a user that holds a lot of money. And the number of fully validating nodes in Starknet can be very easily a very, very high number, independent on what is the size or cost to run a proof. So that's one.
Yeah.
And now the second thing that I want to say is that even today on Bitcoin or Ethereum, but let's talk about Bitcoin for a second. Even today on Bitcoin, the eventually there are like a small number of entities that run most of the mining operation. And a single computer, it's very hard for it to compete on the mining process. So one could, at the beginning, could say, well, eventually it's going to evolve to like huge machines that crank, whatever, 2 to the 50 hashes per second. And therefore, I don't like it because it's going to be centralized. Eventually, those miners, they have not so much power. And they're also splitting the power, for example, with the mining pool and so on. And the cost to run a prover, while it's high, it's definitely not the same as the cost to run like a miner that mines significant part in the Bitcoin chain. It's much lower, right? It's maybe 100 times more than running the original computation, maybe a few hundreds of times. But it's low enough that, yes, you will need a large machine, but it's definitely something that probably most people could get or unite to get or be part of if they wished to. So I think that, and obviously, even if there would be just few machines and they will always be live and will only spin your machine if there is risk, you can't never in this network, you can never have a state transition that is illegal. It just doesn't happen. And the number of the size of the network of the full validating node is anyway going to be very high.
I want to say that I don't think decentralization will be harmed in the long run because for one, as you explained, you can have full trust in what someone proves to you as being correct. And the other aspect is that generating a proof, while it is computation intensive, it is not so bad. It is far simpler and far cheaper to set up than running a mining rig, for instance. And, you know, I think proof of work mining, for better or worse, is our, like, you know, best example so far for decentralization, right? That's what Bitcoin and Ethereum and many other layer ones are running now. So there's a lot of centralization and, you know, buying dedicated hardware in the mining world, but it's still our best. It's the best we've seen so far in terms of decentralization. So Stark production is going to be much cheaper. It's much easier to run on your, you know, end user computers. It's already the case now, and it will be even more so when we have things like, you know, recursion and things like that that are going to be coming soon and will be a very important part of Starknet. So when you talk about recursion, it means you can take a long computation and break it up into a large number of small chunks, and then each one of them can be proved, Stark proved on a very low-end computer. So I don't think you'll see necessarily these huge, you know, you won't see the analog of the mining rigs in terms of decentralization of Stark proving, but it's a good question.
Yeah. So what are sort of, I mean, I guess if you're talking about like breaking up the computation to several or I don't know, I guess many different machines, what is sort of like the ballpark of the minimum requirements that there is right now?
So right now,
you mentioned, and it's maybe speak about recursion a bit because it makes everything as clear as that.
Yeah, we haven't turned on recursion yet. You know, we're working on it. But once you have recursion, I'm guessing that the hardware that will be needed to participate in producing proofs of Starknet is probably going to be something, let's say, I don't know, anywhere between
4 and 16 cores, and anywhere between let's say 16 and 128 gigabytes of RAM, you could probably comfortably fit in. So, you know, some computer that's, I don't know, if you buy it at a store, maybe will cost you, I don't know, $3,000. Or if you rent it on Amazon, it will be a very small number of dollars per month. So very a commodity hardware. You don't need any special GPUs or things like that. This is my guesstimate. You know, we haven't finalized things yet.
Yeah, sounds. I mean, sounds cool. And yeah, definitely, would definitely like to run one of these once it's available. I think you said it's already permissionless, but yeah, I guess it's not fully documented on how to run this right
now. No, it's not yet. We don't have yet the proven software decentralized and open. This will be the third phase of Starknet, which we'll start working on in the summer, so we expect it to be ready by roughly the end of the year. At that stage, there will be software that anyone can run.
Yeah, awesome. I can continue if no one else is. Thanks, Doc.
I'll have you wait. I'll have you wait for the. Right. We can circle back. We can circle back to you. Let's do the next question from Ridgendale.
Hey, thanks.
Please, sir.
Yeah, hey, thanks, guys. Thanks for doing this.
It is.
Yeah, thank you. Super exciting stuff. Like, I'm really excited about Starks for both blockchain scaling. You know, I'd love to see an OpStark Verify land in Bitcoin one day, but also for, you know, putting trust into client-side computation where normally you have to have untrusted clients. Question for you from the reading I've done on how Starks work, there are parts of a Stark that are probabilistic proofs, like the FRIs, I think are, you know, very high probability, but, you know, they're still probabilistic. As you guys have customers or partners that are putting, you know, very high value batches of transactions into Starks, do you have any concerns or how are you thinking about, like, a point where, you know, the collision resistance of one of these like probabilistic proofs against the dollar value, you know, that's being protected by the proof, starts, you know, becoming an attractive target for somebody trying to forge invalid proofs. Is that a thing that you guys think about at all? Or is that just like a bad question?
No, it's a terrific question, and we do think about it. And indeed, you can, and you should think about the dollar value, and you know what is the likelihood of a collision, and then how you know what how low do you want to get your error probability or the probability of something bad happen. So first, I want to say that I mean you may know this. I mean, as your as the name you picked indicates, you're familiar with Rindell and with other crypto primitives. So the sad truth is that all cryptography has some probability of bad shit happening. Usually it's quantified by this thing called the you know, security parameter or, you know, the number of bits of security. And I think people today think that 128 bits of security is roughly as, you know, good enough, meaning that you know, the assumption is that no one on the face of the earth has enough resources to mount an attack that an expectation takes 2^128 steps to take. So, but if we ever reach a point, you know, I don't know, aliens come and they show us how to do things a zillion X faster, you might want to move to something like, let's say, 256 bits of security, which means your probability of error is 2^-256. And in this case, what's going to happen is that you'll roughly, you'll get, everything will work just as before. You'll just replace your hash functions when constructing Starks with something slightly with larger digest size, and you'll be increasing the size of the proofs. So I guess they'll go up if you need to move from 128 bits
to, let's say, 256, I guess that instead of a single proof being 50 kilobytes, I don't know, it's going to go up to, let's say, 200 kilobytes, you know, something like that. So not the end of the world. But great question.
Great. Thanks, Rindale. And next question from Stratum. Is Stratum around? Yes, no? Okay. I'll bring in the next one. So next question from Anonymous. That's a good name. Are you with us, Anonymous? Anonymous, any questions?
Yes. Is it true that
go ahead.
StarkNet operators can freeze assets?
Can you repeat your question?
Is it true that
I didn't hear it very well.
Is it true that StarkNet operators can freeze assets?
So I think it's a good question, first of all. And I think Eddie mentioned earlier that at this point, we have just a single operator and we're running StarkNet in alpha mode, in a single operator mode. But as soon as there is a decentralized StarkNet, and that's the target eventually, that's what we want to do in StarkNet. So towards the end of the year, hopefully we get there. Everyone can run an operator, and then it is not possible for any single operator to freeze anything, because in the worst case, if same as like in Bitcoin or Ethereum, if you are being censored by one operator, then there will be another operator that will take your transaction and will enable you to move your asset or take it outside the StarkNet to Ethereum or to anywhere else you'd like, or whatever you would like to do with this asset. So once there are multiple operators, there is no censorship anymore, and there is no chance of a single operator freezing your assets or anything like that. Does it make sense?
Yeah, I was just wondering because ZK rollups like ZK Sync, it is not possible for any assets to be frozen or kept off. Validium's work, that is possible.
So StarkNet is operating in a fully ZK rollup at this point, and we are going to add also some other cheaper ways of storage. But in any case, once there is like multi-operators, there is no way to freeze your assets whatsoever. And one more thing, if you already mentioned that, in StarkNet today, it's possible to take out assets even if the operator is not cooperating. So even if there is a single operator, there are ways to enable every user that wish to take his asset off-chain, even if the back to the chain, even if the operator is not cooperating. But in StarkNet, once there is decentralization, you won't even have to have this part.
Okay, one more question. When will the prover be open source?
Ellie, you want to take that, or should I?
Yeah, we plan to release the code for the prover within part of this decentralization task, you know, that nominally by the end of the year, or maybe Q1 of the next year, but roughly ballpark that time. And our current plan is to hand over the license of the prover under the Polaris license to the StarkNet ecosystem. We'll find some way to deal with governance of that ecosystem. And the ecosystem of StarkNet is going to decide exactly what to do with it. One decision it may reach is to open source it. It may also reach other decisions, again, by some governance mechanism. You know, maybe it's going to allow it only on blockchains, or, you know, one thing or the other. But this will be something that we want to entrust into the hands of the StarkNet ecosystem. And by the end of the year, you know, I don't know, or Q1 of next year.
All right, great. Thanks for the question. And let's see, BTC Stratum, are you here now?
Hey, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Terrific. Okay, cool. So one thing that, you know, I was wondering about is Bitcoin has obviously followed a pretty lean scaling approach. These proofs appear to be pretty large in size. Where do you think we would actually, you know, be able to put these proofs? And do you kind of imagine a world in which the data is available on Bitcoin, or are you seeing a higher likelihood potentially of using kind of a secondary data availability layer like Celestia?
I want to address this. There's something that often gets people get confused about this notion of proof size. What you really, really care about is amortized number of bytes per transaction, right? Because a Bitcoin block today is a few megabytes large, right? What if within those few megabytes you could fit 100x more transactions, right? You'd be happy no matter how exactly these megabytes are used. So this is exactly what happens with a Stark proof. I'll give the example of a DYDX batch. We currently generate proofs that are, let's say, in the 50 to 100 kilobytes per proof. So it sounds a lot. However, each one of these proofs covers on DYDX around 13,000 transactions. So assuming this is 100 kilobytes, if you cover 10,000 transactions, now someone's going to need to help me with the math. So you take 100 kilobytes divided by, that's 100,000 divided by 10,000. And that's, I think, 10. So it's 10 bytes per transaction. Right. I think I got it right. So, yeah. So you now think of something similar would happen on Bitcoin. Suppose you had a proof that's 100 kilobytes, right? So within the Bitcoin block, it takes 100 kilobytes. That's, you know, that sucks. But these 100 kilobytes take care of, I don't know, a million transactions, right? Or 100,000 of them. You'll be very happy. And that's exactly what's going to happen when Stark proofs are going to be on Bitcoin. Now, you're right that the data availability, like what is the state, is another issue that you have to think about. There it's a separate question, but the proofs themselves are not the issue, and their size is not the issue.
Gotcha. Yeah. And I would say, you know, some people might be upset about 50 kilobyte proofs, but if you're a miner and, you know, currently transaction fees are like 1% of block reward, I imagine you'd be pretty happy with that. So there's definitely a contingent that would be excited about this as well.
Yep.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for the question. For the next question, we have Guy. What's up, Guy?
Hi. Thanks for the space. My question is, were you thinking of deploying one Starknet layer 2 or multiple ones? Each of them deploy separately on the blockchain proof or Stark opcode.
You want to take it?
No, go ahead, Ali.
Okay. So our plan right now, we're a very small team, and I think it's pretty amazing what we achieved so far, but it's only because we focused and on doing very, very simple things that we have all of our effort on. So the only thing we're focusing on right now is basically putting Starknet on Ethereum, and just one Starknet with one state and one global state. Now, a very interesting question is what's going to happen after that. I don't think we're planning like a second Starknet on Ethereum, and I'm not sure it makes a lot of sense because it would slightly fragment, liquidity and things like that. It's inevitable that this technology will deploy on other L1s, right? Because it's good technology, so everyone's going to use it. Now, how is this going to play out, and whether Starkware or the Starknet ecosystem is going to help that, participate in it? I don't know. It's too early to say. But if you ask, will there be other Starknets that are part of other L1s? I'm pretty sure that the answer is yes, even though I'm not sure that Starkware can commit too many resources to making that happen.
I guess that my question was, isn't there a trade-off for doing, isn't it cheaper to scale if you're deploying different fragmented layer 2 Starknet on the same blockchain?
Yeah, we might see some
you know, some form of sharding of the storage, but I'm not sure it will be by deploying Starknet in different places or even on the same blockchain. It makes more sense to deploy Stark. I'm going to say something confusing. To deploy Starknet instances or StarkX on top of Starknet, and then you can say, well, if your application is very storage heavy and you don't care, for example, to run with a smaller set of operators or maybe a single operator, then take an instance of Starknet or StarkX and make sure that the verification of this instance happens on the public Starknet that everyone knows. But then you run it as, pardon my French, a layer 3. And that gives you basically the ability to keep your storage separately from everyone else's storage, but still make sure that every state transition is valid. And it's still much cheaper to run it on Starknet than to run it as separate Starknet instances on Ethereum, for example. That will make more sense.
Got it. Thanks.
And you can actually achieve cheaper or even higher scale with it, right? Because now the storage of not important apps is not bothering everyone on the public side. And the verification of state transitions is still cheap because it's done on Stark.
Yeah, so instead of deploying multiple layer 2, you're deploying multiple layer 3 on top of the one single layer 2.
Correct. And that's the plan. And thanks. I think there is a chance that we will see like a first layer 3, maybe even sometimes this year.
That's a lot of layers. That's a lot of layers. Thanks for the question,
yeah,
guy.
I know.
And for the next question, we have Matteo. Hey, Matteo, welcome.
Yes. Do you hear me?
Okay. Yep.
Okay. My question is about token, because I read that Starknet doesn't have a token. So how is possible to bet on Starknet?
I can take it. So to your question about token, I'll repeat the answer that we said many times, no comment. Now to your question, how to, I'm not sure, I don't know how to bet on this or that. And certainly whatever I say is not any sort of investment advice, but the best way to, you know, be part of Starknet is to join the Discord. To, if you're looking, there are many teams there that are building a bunch of stuff, so you know, either joining them, supporting them in whatever way, or you know, just joining the ecosystem. I think the analog would be you know, Ethereum is launching or about to launch, has just launched. What do you want to do? Well, you probably want to join some team, build something, test some things, you know, do some stuff on it. I think the same thing.
Yeah, that's a good one. Find someone who's doing something with Starks and join them, or do it yourself, right? That's a good advice.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, I would have asked, if no one else would have asked, I would have asked one token, if only to get that answer. Okay, next question, and thanks, Matteo, for that. And next question from A Priori.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for doing the spaces. Question, going back to what Avi was just discussing. You guys published a piece on fractal scaling and potentially with a layer 3 and a layer 4. Is there a theoretical limit to fractal scaling? Or would there be any advantages to, like, let's say in the future, having a layer 6 or a layer 7, and could that unlock some cool combinations with building different dApps?
There are theoretical limits, yes. There definitely are theoretical limits, because security deteriorates with the number of layers of recursion. Yes, but I mean, these are theoretical limits. Practically speaking,
You know, I think it's going to be, you lose a lot of the benefits if you go too deep. I don't know what too deep is, but.
I agree. I think.
Yeah, I just wanted to answer that theoretically there are limits. It cannot go to infinity. There are mathematical reasons that I don't want to go into that prevent that.
Yeah, but I think also just to add to it, I think that from like practical reasons, at least the first few years, you don't keep it as like getting security from Ethereum to the public decentralized darknet makes sense. Keeping the layer 2 decentralized and permissionless so everyone can run an operator and nobody is being censored. And then having on layer 3, like some heavy operations, heavy applications that requires like more storage or stuff like that, while maybe they are not decentralized, maybe they are yes, but they enjoy from the cheap verification cost on Starknet layer. And I think at this point you get already like so many benefits that going like deeper is like complex and unknown, and I don't think it will be necessary, but you know, I don't want to make these kind of predictions. They might be surprised in a year or two.
Appreciate it. Thank you, guys.
Thanks for the question. And for our last question, let's go to Idan. Hey, Idan.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yep, yep.
Cool, thanks. Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about spam transactions. So we've seen lately that on Solana, for example, when transactions were extremely low cost, so the network was kind of susceptible for a denial of service tax. So basically, you can take up all of the block space because it's that cheap. And I wondered if you think about this kind of a risk on layer two, is it different from layer ones, or is it the same problem? And how do you think about mitigating it, if it's relevant at all?
Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll start and then Eli can add on top. I think, like, first of all, we're thinking about it. In Solana, there wasn't really any fee market, so you obviously get into this problem. Starknet is an earlier phase in alpha, but the next version of Starknet is going to include fees as an option. And at this point, since the sequencer is centralized, there is anyway some a good level of control by the sequencer, with fees it becomes an easy one. But we spent a lot of time thinking on the right mechanisms to prevent denial of service. There are differences. There are all kind of differences. Some of them comes from what you want to deal with when you deal with proving. Maybe you want to prove reverted transactions like exist and being fulfilled on Ethereum, or do you want to work with a different denial of service mechanism? It's a very interesting question. There are like all kinds of very different technical directions to it. We actually, maybe it's a good place to mention it instead of going into each and every method at this point. We have a discourse. The name is Starknet Shamans, and you can just Google Starknet Shamans or Starknet Community and you'll get there. And this is like the place where we keep all kinds of technical discussions about denial of service mechanisms and about leader election. But we definitely spend a lot of time in cycles choosing the right denial of service mechanism. And we are very well aware that it's a possibility.
All right. All right. Awesome. Thanks for the question, Idan. And I think that's it, Avio and Eli. I think we're going to wrap it up.
So, Udi, have you learned all that you wanted?
I feel like I learned a lot. I kind of, I went from...
I mean, you know, we're hiring, right?
I went from an boom. Expert in... I went from a zero knowledge... Wait, what did I want to say? You confused me. Being an expert in having zero knowledge to being a zero knowledge expert. Wow. Perfectly executed joke. Now you should hire
me. Good, because we're looking, we're looking to hire also in the joke department. So, you know.
Spend a lot of time on those things, Dudy.
Yeah.
I'll work on it. Well, thanks so much for taking time, and thanks everyone for listening in.
Thanks to the audience for the great questions.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. It was fun.
Thanks for checking out another episode of The Ether. That was Udiverse Learns About Starknet, recorded on Monday, March 7th, 2022. This episode of The Ether was brought to you by WeFund. WeFund is a community crowdfunding cross-chain incubator on Terra, and it's the first launchpad that implements a milestone funding release system to protect investors. All money raised for projects is deposited in Anchor Protocol, and it's refundable, and all decisions are based on community voting power. WeFund is community-focused and designed to be a user-friendly experience for both project creators and investors. Be sure to follow them on Twitter and join the Telegram for more information. Links are in the show notes, and check them out online at WeFund.app. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by Glow Yield. Glow Yield is the ecosystem of Terra decentralized apps like Lotto and Creators, all powered by DeFi Yields. Glow Creators helps artists and influencers give their fans exclusive perks through membership, NFTs, and more. Glow Lotto is a PrizeLink savings account with a weekly chance to win the big jackpot. Tickets are free and perpetual, which means there's zero chance to lose money. Be sure to follow Glow Yield on Twitter and join the Discord community to stay up to date with all the glowing projects, and check them out online at glowyield.com. This episode of The Ether is also brought to you by Talus. Talus Protocol is the NFT platform for independent artists on Terra. Talus helps to provide artists with the tools and resources needed to transition from traditional art into the NFT world. With their V1 launch coming soon, Talus will be the place to see real-world art reflected on Terra. Be sure to join their Telegram and follow Talus on Twitter for updates on their roadmap, validator, and other Talus news. Find your next favorite artist on talus.art. Terra Spaces appreciates the support from all our sponsors. For TerraSpaces.org, I'm Finn. Thanks for listening. I'm running out the gate, rapping, step up to the plate. Represent the base when I'm rapping out my fate. Used to play ball, now I'm sitting on the bench like a mitt. Like to play dumb, so you can't tell me shit. Never gonna get me like a raise in your 50s. And if we go drifting, you better whip it swiftly. I'm on empty, feeling peppy enough to do a fucking barrel roll. Running out of air like this planet isn't terraformed. Looking terrible, like you need a breath. Getting cancer from these wearables, feeling kinda blessed. Tracking everywhere we go, error bars low. Here we are, so I guess we put the terror in the art show. I'm not a leader, but I'll lead if you mislead her. While the creature comfort certified up in this teacher, feeling like a tenure isn't even needed. Taking all that hunger, trying to feed it. Learning how to love life before we get defeated. Yeah. Rhythm. Gonna get it last, never mind the mass. Time's velocity divided by the past. Can't fight the facts, rhyming fast. Lighting around, in fact, a little backhand should straighten up these little rats. You better pay attention to the dude that's spitting facts. Everybody likes to rap about how they got no attachment. Straight abandoned in the back of some shitty shack. Learn how to eat from watching dogs fight over trash. If you think I'm crass, brash, being a little ass, I'm feeling a little bashful about bringing the illest back. It's like the virus brought the violence from the lowest to the highest, and we all got super quiet like the Mayans. And I don't even know where the fuck we go from here. A bunch of long hairs, growing beards, not showing fear. One step forward, taking two steps back. And pray to your mother we don't hit a crack. Terra Spaces.